and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the third week of February. My name is Elise Hugh with regular Tribcaster Ben Philpott of KUT News and the Tribune. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
And Evan and Ross are taking a Tribcast break today, so we have Reeve Hamilton and Brandi Grissom, fellow Tribune reporters. Hi, y'all.
Hello.
Hey, Elise.
So today we're going to be talking the second major staff shakeup of the Farrukh Shammi campaign, seniority, Republican seniority in the Texas House, and what they're giving up in this election cycle with seniority, the EPA suit that is coming from the state of Texas, and what's going on over in El Paso. So let's start with Reeve and what's up with Farrukh Shammi.
Well, sort of a bombshell just dropped. Farrukh Shammi's campaign had its, like you said, its second major shakeup. Five staffers, including all the top aides, have stepped down. The first time all his top aides stepped down was 3 weeks into his campaign when Jason Stafford and Joel Kuhn left. Now it's Vince Leibowitz, Charlie Ray, who was his press secretary, Kelly Love Johnson, who was his communications director. And they left because there was a bit of a kerfuffle, you might say. When David Diaz, who is this PR guy from the Valley, sent a press release to reporters going after Bill White, Shammi's opponent.
And a bit of a bomb. I mean, it wasn't a nice little, we disagree on the issues. It was Bill White is racist, essentially, right?
Essentially, yes. And it got picked up by Texas Insider and some other places.
As a news story.
Right.
A press release relayed as a news story.
Right. And so after that, an internal memo from the Shammi campaign accidentally got sent to reporters. So already they're confused because they're sending internal memos out and they don't know who's sending their releases. But this internal memo said, who is David Diaz? He does not speak for the campaign. David Diaz referred questions to Jessica Gutierrez, who is Shammi's corporate spokesperson. Shammi came back and said, both of these people do speak for my campaign. And so then all of his the people he had hired to speak for his campaign were like, oh, well, then we're out of here.
So is there any word on what this means for his 10,000 jobs promise?
100,000 jobs.
Oh, 100,000. That's right.
Well, I guess the promises could shift now.
Well, he's created so many spokesperson jobs just in his campaign so far.
Zing!
Awesome.
So it's already... This is already like really bad because the people who considered themselves A-team, the ones who were fired 3 weeks into the campaign, already viewed Vince Leibowitz and the other people who were brought in as B-team. So now these B-team people are saying this is unprofessional. So, I mean, when your junior varsity leaves too, you're basically just left with the candidate
himself. Freshman. But these are not nobodies. I mean, David Diaz has been doing this kind of thing for years. Jessica Gutierrez, I don't know.
She knows how to sell Chi products.
Right.
And they sell.
They do sell.
They do sell.
I mean, you know, I think that this is something that we've talked about in previous podcasts, the difference between running a political campaign and running a business. No one would argue that Farrukh Shammi has not been a successful, extremely successful businessman. No one would argue that his corporate communications department doesn't do a good job getting the message out about the Chi. The problem is they haven't quite figured out that it's different when you're talking about a campaign.
And this is actually, if you can believe it, sort of the second major problem in less than a week for the Shammi campaign. At the end of last week, they had that incident where he went on, well, I guess you got to go back even to just sort of a general campaign implosion week. You had Deborah Medina last Thursday saying that she wouldn't disavow the 9/11 truther movement,
which is the U.S. government had something to do with the orchestrated the attacks on September 11th.
Right.
She said she wouldn't take a position. Just to be fair to her, right?
That's true. Which is not disavowing, but it's also not. I mean, it's in no way supporting. And she afterwards said, you know, I believe that the government was not involved. I know it was terrorists. But anyway, she did not have a good day on Thursday with that. We don't have evidence yet that it's necessarily hurt her, do we?
No, no evidence yet.
But anyway, that happened. Then on Friday, Shammi was asked the same question, and he gave the same answer that she gave.
Oh, his was even better, though. Not only do we not know about 9/11, we don't know who killed Kennedy. So how could we know who orchestrated 9/11?
But we do know, apparently, that white people don't want to work.
Right.
Right.
So there was that, too.
He said he didn't like to hire white people, or didn't generally hire white people, just as a practice.
Because they want to be paid more, and they want better positions.
Right. So that was a bad day. That was Friday, right?
That was Friday.
So this is Wednesday. We're just, with a holiday, it's really just two business days later. It's been a rough week for that campaign.
Well, I'm sorry.
Good news for Farrukh Shami. When I was in El Paso, his signs were everywhere. I mean, every place that you saw any campaign signs, there were two or three Farrukh signs. And I saw hardly any for Bill White when I was out there. So I thought that was really kind of fascinating. Like, what is going on with Farrukh in El Paso?
So maybe with all the plays on race and plays on Mexican Americans, he is winning over a certain segment of the population.
The day without sunshine.
Right. I mean, he did get the endorsement of the Mexican-American
Democrats.
And, you know, apparently is doing pretty anecdotally from what I've heard, that's what the valley looks like, too. So, you know.
I think he gets a lot of stroke in those areas with his promises for jobs and, you know.
Well, El Paso is also where he's going to be building his first solar factory.
And his second one.
Right.
According to the, right. In the debate, he said the
pull yourself together, Ben.
Solar factory was going to be in El Paso, and the second one would be in El Paso, too. So I guess this whole thing, this whole implosion, if you will, leads to my question that I've been questioning kind of, I guess, each week in Tribcast, which is, how much should we even pay attention to Farrukh Shami? Are we only paying attention? Originally, it seemed like the reason we paid attention to him was because he was throwing millions of dollars around. But now that this is clearly not a professional operation, should we even be sitting here talking about it?
Well, but
we
it's kind of fun.
That's true.
I mean, it's fun to watch.
And we do have polls now. Now, Farrukh Shami's candidacy has been polled. He's polling way behind Bill White. But he's still polling, I think,
11%.
That's double digits.
I mean, it is double digits. And I think that
he polled 24% in El Paso, according to their poll.
Well, there you go. See, and I think for a place like El Paso, it makes even more sense. But, you know, we talked about Deborah Medina when she was at 4% and 5%. Now, that then led to her, along with a couple of pretty good debate performances, led to her getting, you know, close to 20%. And you know, possibly passing Senator Hutchison in the last poll, I guess. But I don't know. I mean, Farrukh Shami came from 0% and is now at 11% and is now having trouble internally, at least, staying on however many messages they're trying to put out. So I don't know.
I think there's something to the whole storyline, though, of, you know, that takes a lot more than just money to run a successful campaign.
Yes.
And perhaps, you know, that is the story here is, you know, even though he may not have any chances of winning, he's put a lot of money and effort into it. And I mean, he's working hard, even if it may not go anywhere.
It's almost like Deborah Medina is the polar opposite in a lot of ways from Farrukh Shami. She has no money, but has a very specific, finely tuned message that she's delivering. And boom, she's into the 20% range. Shami has millions of dollars kind of all over the place with lots of different messages. I mean, they all end up focusing on jobs, but just
jobs, jobs, jobs,
jobs, jobs. But, and he's, you know, at 11%.
So let's turn to the Republicans for a moment. My topic this week is about how a lot of House Republicans are retiring or facing primary challenges in which the incumbent could lose and therefore lose seniority. Those of us who cover the legislature, all of us in here, know that seniority is everything in the House. With 150 members, half of appropriations picks are based on seniority. Chairmanships are based on seniority. Even your parking spot and where you sit, all based on seniority. What the situation that Republicans will find themselves in this next class and with a large class of freshmen coming in is that a lot of chairmen are possibly going to lose in the primary in March. Getting pretty strong challenges. Finance chair, longtime Senate finance chair, Steve Ogden is facing this challenge from Ben Bias. Who else is leaving?
Well, you've got people like former state affairs chair Swinford.
Swinford's
who is
out.
Retiring.
Todd Smith is in danger up in Euless. And so we could see a major shift in Republican membership of the House, even if they do pick up a few seats. But in terms of seniority, they lose some power there. So I guess I want to talk about whether it's the juice is worth the squeeze when it comes to challenging fellow Republicans. I had to throw out a Rossism in there.
Well, you have, for example, Michael Quinn Sullivan's Empower Texans has really been going after Todd Smith for voter ID, saying he didn't do enough to support it. Other people have come back and said, well, I mean, Todd Smith is the only person that had a realistic plan that could have actually passed for voter ID. So maybe that's like a really good example of possibly shooting yourself in the foot by trying to oust him.
Right. You don't get the person who is at least going to get something effective. You know, I guess perfect is the enemy of good.
Well, I mean, if she was on the committee, so I'll bring up her name. If Betty Brown were the chair of that elections committee, her bill, her idea for voter ID may have very well made it out of that elections committee, but it would have gotten 50 votes on the House floor and that would have been it. I mean, based on kind of the feel that we got during the last session. So, yeah, Todd Smith's bill appeared to have the votes in the House. He couldn't get it out of his own committee, so, you know.
And if in Ross's absence, I should mention that Vicky Truitt also is in danger, pensions and investments chair. Right. She's been chairman for under Craddock and under Strauss, and so she may be in danger in
Brian
her
McCall
own
also left the calendars committee chair.
Right, so in terms of retirees and in terms of primary challenges, Republicans may be facing a loss in seniority, and I just wonder how that's going to shape next session.
I don't know that it'll shape the I think it'll shape individual districts more than it will shape an entire session, because there's plenty of, it's a Republican majority in everywhere. So there's plenty of people to pick from, even if they're maybe 10 years younger. I'm interested in seeing what happens in the Swinford seat, not who wins, but, you know, Swinford's district up in the Panhandle is sandwiched between two other districts. And it was kind of a district drawn to, you know, grab as many people as possible, create this district area. Well, the population up there continues to shrink and shrink and shrink now that he's gone, and it'll be a freshman lawmaker, Republican or Democrat, taking his place. Who is going to fight to keep that seat when you're talking about redistricting? And the rural areas of Texas will have to lose a few to the growing urban areas of Texas. So that one gets, you know, closed right in the middle of that, of those other two districts up there, maybe. Maybe not, but that's going to be kind of the battle if you have freshmen in the rural areas going up against longtime senior people in the urban areas, and, you know, population shift, you might lose a district out there.
And it's not just, you know, Chairman Swinford. Isett is also leaving.
Gone. Right.
Right.
Jones is also leaving, or could potentially be leaving. I mean, there could be a lot of new faces from that area, and it could be a serious power shift for them.
So maybe it's more of an urban-rural shift instead of a young and old.
Well, yeah, Delwyn Jones is interesting, considering he would, if he is indeed reelected, and he's facing a pretty tough challenge in Lubbock, if he is indeed reelected, he is currently the chairman of the committee that handles redistricting, which we're expecting in 2011. So that's going to be humongous. It would be interesting to see who Strauss would put in there in Jones's place and how redistricting changes under a different chairmanship. So all kinds of things are colored by this.
That's, of course, assuming that the Democrats don't take over the majority in the state house.
I think we're writing that one off. in deference to Evan, who would be sitting here saying that right now. So, well, as we're talking about the House, Brandi, you were in El Paso last week and did reporting there. Obviously, it's Democrats in El Paso more than Republicans, but what's going on?
Well, out in El Paso is pretty much the Republicans' best shot for getting back a seat on the border in terms of the legislature. For a long time, Pat Hagerty was the only Republican from the border in the legislature, and he lost back in 2008, as we'll remember from that fairly nasty campaign he had with DeMargo. But DeMargo then lost in the general election to Joe Moody, who's a Democrat and served his first term in 2009. Well, so now the Republicans are looking to take that seat back and take on Joe and take him down. And so there are actually three Republicans out there who are vying for the seat, but two that are sort of more prominent: DeMargo, who beat Hagerty before, and then Jay Kleberg, who is sort of a newcomer to not only El Paso politics, but relatively new to El Paso. He's lived there for about 6 years. He's from the Kleberg family of the King Ranch, so he's got some financial backing, and actually he's got more
some
money.
Some delicious recipes.
Yes,
what?
An
the
excellent
Kleberg
casserole.
Family recipes.
Or King Ranch,
King Ranch
chicken.
Pie.
Is
it? Oh, that's right. Oh, that's from Ding. Okay.
And the King Ranch Ford F-150.
There's that one too. So, and they're just two candidates who couldn't be more different from one another than you could possibly imagine, except for that They're both Republican. D is older. His kids are grown. He's lived in El Paso for 30 years. He's got this campaigning thing down pat. And J, this is his first campaign. He's 31. He's just super excited about El Paso and can't hardly get him to stop talking. He's running a really hard campaign and out there with lots of signs and going door to door. And, you know, D's name is already known, so he doesn't have to do a lot of those things. And the El Paso poll showed that he's pretty far ahead in the polling in that district. So it'll be interesting to see which one of them sort of comes out on top next week.
Is one of them the more conservative one? Because what we're seeing in the Republican primaries is the more conservative candidate and the more moderate candidate, or at least the more conservative person wanting to paint the contest that way. So is DeMarco, you know, because he was Craddock-backed in 2008, is he considered more right-leaning?
Definitely. He okay. is, in his radio commercial that I heard out there talked about how, you know, he wants lower property taxes and he's going to oppose Washington mandates and all of those sort of, you know, conservative talking points. And their campaign, the DeMarco campaign, just actually sent out a tweet not too long ago about how their opponent, Kleberg, voted for Obama in 2008. And he is, you know, a little bit more moderate and talks about, you know, crossing, you know, over the aisle to talk to both sides. But keep in mind that district is almost 50-50. It's, even though it is a Republican district, it's been trending more and more Democratic. So it may be a situation where, you know, in the Republican primary, they may choose the more conservative candidate, but that may make it harder for that person to get out of the general election.
Kind of like the Rick versus Kay problem.
The theory there is the same thing, that Bill White's best chance is to have a hard right running Rick Perry get out of the primary, maybe with a runoff.
Well, Ben, I'm glad you mentioned Rick Perry, because this week Perry is picking another battle with the federal government regarding environmental regulation.
Yeah, you know, Governor Perry has not been happy at all about cap and trade legislation. And you've even had Democrats in the state, a Democratic congressman in the state who voted against the House version of cap and trade when it was passed last year, I believe. Texas as a whole, Texas lawmakers as a whole, because of the energy produced and the industry in the state, have not been very happy with it. Well, Tuesday was the final day to issue challenges to the EPA beginning to regulate carbon as a pollutant. And so Texas joined in with, I think, Alabama and Virginia were the other two, at least three of them, all filed suit to stop the EPA from regulating carbon. So, the Texas argument is that, I believe it was called a global warming gate. There have been a series of emails that have come out from the UN's UN-backed scientific team that put out research on global warming and climate change. Several different emails have kind of come to light saying, well, you know, this information may have been falsified. This data may have been tweaked the wrong way. So, you know, there may be some scientific questions here or there on the validity of the report. Governor Perry and Attorney General Greg Abbott and Todd Staples all had a press conference this week saying, well, based on all this, we are suing to stop the EPA from doing what they're trying to do. We'll see how far it goes. The Texas suit and the other state suits are about stopping this cap and trade legislation and stopping the government, you know, expecting more stringent requirements on carbon, releasing carbon into the air for individual states. And the lawsuits are going after these perceived problems or reported problems within the report. The environmentalists say, look, it's a scientific debate. When you do a scientific debate, you have some people with different opinions, but that doesn't mean that the overall mountain of evidence isn't pointing in one direction. And, you know, we'll see where the lawsuit goes. It may go nowhere. It may be a publicity stunt, but like I said, I think there are at least three states that have all filed individual suits against the federal government on this one.
Well, this brings two questions to mind for me, and anyone can tackle either of them, but I'll lay them both out at the same time. They're not really related at all. The first one is, what does this say about or say further about our state's relationship with the federal government, we had Julian Castro spoke at one of our Trip Live events this morning, and that was one of the things they discussed is he advised communities that wanted federal funding for things to just go around the state and make your pitch directly to the government, because if you want, say, education funding or really anything, that this the relationship right now between the state and the federal government is not that strong. This would clearly seem to be an indication of that. No. The second thing is our state also seems to not be that enthusiastic, or maybe less enthusiastic than some other states, about science. We just had a poll that came out that said that I think 30% of Texans believe that dinosaurs and humans walked the earth at the same time. Now, I'm not claiming to know, you know, how it was,
that old.
But I think the mountain of evidence certainly points in one direction.
Yeah, that was an interesting story. Ross Ramsey did that. I believe he titled it "Here's Meet the Flintstones." You know, that I don't know what
so
to say about that poll.
It's a war on Washington and a war on science.
Well, and even Todd Staples said yesterday that, you know, hey, look, I mean, it used to be called global warming, and now all of a sudden it's called climate change. I don't know that there's actually a difference between the two, although I think scientists have tried to reframe it as climate change because of so many people who put out emails last week saying, hey, how can it be global warming? Because D.C. is under, or Dallas is under a foot of snow.
Right. Drudge Report has that headline almost every week.
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Well, and on the topic of, you know, our relationship with the federal government, I wonder how much that will change after, you know, March 2nd. And
good point.
The federal government isn't all of a sudden, you know, this Washington enemy that is trying to be defeated. So, you know, will things get better? Will the rhetoric calm down?
I think the rhetoric might calm down. You know, we've had, what, in the last legislative session, Governor Perry railing against the government, getting ready for this run against Kay Bailey Hutchison. But at the same time, what he really only turned down was one thing.
Right.
Now he's turned down another one thing this year with the Race to the Top money.
But he was, you know, using federal money from the stimulus package to help fund border security operations that are a big part of his platform.
Right.
So
maybe I don't know. I mean, to quote Paul Burka, we may not see the rhetoric slow down until, you know, he's on that, Governor Perry is on the Republican ballot for president in 2012. But we'll see how that goes.
Do you know if and what the strings were that were attached to the border funding?
I didn't actually see any strings, but I don't know.
And Julian Castro, just back to the Castro thing real quickly on federal versus or the relationship with between the feds and the state. Castro did point out that all federal money does come with certain mandates. You know, No Child Left Behind came with education money, but also accountability standards. I mean, this is kind of just a standard deal in a lot of cases of federal money. We did take most of the stimulus, 97% of it. So all of that probably came with various rules as well.
Though I assume there are certain strings that can be pulled more easily than others.
Yes, and there are certain strings that are more offensive to the state leadership than others.
Right. I mean, there was only one state that decided they weren't going to take highway funds because of everyone having to raise the drinking age, right? I mean, Louisiana held out for a few years saying, we're not going to take the federal highway funds because we want the drinking age to still be 18 in New Orleans.
And it's also not as if state funds to local municipalities and local governments don't come without strings either. I mean, if school
Who holds
districts,
the string?
Right. If school districts want money, they have to, you know, report to the TEA and all those other things.
So that's it for the Inmates Running the Asylum version of the Tribcast. On behalf of Ben, Reeve, and Brandy, my name is Elise. Thank you for listening.